Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Edward Millermeyer to the Pemba On Demand podcast. Dr. Millermeyer is an associate certified coach and team practitioner coach. He formed his coaching company, Pivot Partnerships, in 2020 and has been active in coaching for the past 3 to 4 years. Ed and I have had the wonderful opportunity to work together for many years. He graduated from Pemba in 2006. Ed, welcome to Pemba On Demand.
Thanks, Norm. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
It's great to have you here. I'm excited today to talk to you a little bit about your current passion for coaching and mentoring. And I kind of wonder if maybe you can describe a little bit for the audience what it was that attracted you to moving into this arena on a full-time basis.
Ooh, well, it's sort of the culmination of a journey. I've been in primary care for most of my career, a little bit of time spent as a chief medical officer, but for the most part in primary care, either as a practicing clinician or in leadership. Thought I was doing a pretty good job with patients with respect to using a coaching mindset until I took some coaching training and the light bulb was ignited. It really went on and I thought, oh my gosh, there's so much more to this. The beauty was I started to apply it towards the end of my clinical career. And for me, it was like this little epiphany a pretty good sized epiphany that made me think, well, what would it be like if every physician had a coaching mindset? It doesn't mean you give up your expertise, but using a true, fully embraced coaching mindset in clinical work. And I think that's something that continues. I don't think it is. It's something that motivates me to continue doing what I'm doing.
So that's really interesting to me that you started taking some coaching training as you were still practicing as a clinician. Tell me a little bit more about what you mean by the coaching mindset and how you applied it in the practical aspect of dealing with patients. Is it like we talk about with patients where we're doing motivational interviewing, or is it slightly different than that? Maybe you could flesh that out a little bit for us.
It's probably the most commonly asked question as a sort of comparison or analogy. And yes, motivational interviewing is part of this. I think one of the biggest differences is truly, and it's hard for us, but it's truly letting go at some point of the need for expertise and getting completely involved in that patient's agenda. It doesn't mean you don't ask the questions that are rooted in what your understanding is. But it's difficult, I think, for us as clinicians to really fully recognize how little time we actually have with folks and the time in between either our visits or the encounters we have. Even if someone stays in the hospital for a time period, they're on their own. And when fully embraced and fully understood, and making the assumption that most people are whole and complete and will do the right things with the right interactions and the right knowledge, it's very eye-opening and quite transformative in terms of patient relationships. So what do I mean by that? I mean, I got into coaching mainly because we invited a coach to our leadership team. I was still in leadership role, and I was blown away. The rest of the team was like, that was okay. And I thought, oh, I can't force them. I have too many other things in leadership. I have to force might be this too strong a word, but I have to use a lot of influence. I thought, maybe not this one. And but I entered into a relationship. And then as I was transitioning, thinking about what I wanted to do post retirement and such, her encouragement was, Ed, you'd probably be really good at this. I think that's played out. So decided to continue on with not only that relationship, but then did some formal training. And I would say halfway through the training, I started applying it clinically. Really just very fundamental things about what truly what that person is really willing to do and how they would put, if you will, an action plan together. A lot of coaching emphasizes using a lens of curiosity. It's not about being a mentor or an expert or the sage on the stage. It really is about understanding what is truly the agenda of the patient. And yes, motivational interviewing is a key component to that. And yet, when you start thinking about coaching and the action planning side of this, that's where the real rich conversations happen. I distinctly remember a patient or two of mine when I would ask them really what they were willing to do and then ask them, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is this to happen? If they gave me anything less than 8, I'd say, well, you just gave yourself a 40%, if it was 6, a 40% chance of this not working. And they do just what you're doing now, Norm. They kind of smile and go, well, I think I see what you're doing, Doc. I said, well, what am I doing? I said, well, you're kind of pushing me to make a decision. Well, yes, I am. And then I would say, you know, let's talk seriously about this. You might have an hour, maybe an hour and a half total of time with me over a year if you have a relatively stable chronic illness. And the rest of the time, you're on your own. For us to recognize that and then work with you to figure out how it is you can optimize your health in a way that's really aligned with how you think, who you are, what your values are, all of those things, man, it's really quite transformative. And it doesn't take a whole lot of time. In fact, it likely saves you some time because the conversation is more complete.
It's interesting because I hadn't really drawn the when I've always thought about coaching, I have not really thought about it in the clinical sense. I certainly have been aware of the need to sort of apply influence to patients to get them to understand the need to change certain behaviors. But I just never really thought about that as a key coaching principle that you're using in non-clinical situations with executives and physician leaders and found the value in applying that to a clinical situation. That's really fascinating. Just it's kind of an aha moment for me.
Yeah, there's a common thread, Norm. I think that where individuals really, we have to acknowledge in our clinical roles that people are only going to do what they're willing to do. And certainly we saw this in the pandemic when a large number of humans were told, you got to do this. And what we got in response was, wow. So, and that really tested it. It even tested me. I have to admit, there were times when I thought, oh, man, I'm not being very coach-like in this thing. And I could feel it in the relationships. I could feel it in the conversations. So sometimes it's just stepping back and saying, okay. And yeah, you've let your agenda be known and it's not resonating. So let's get curious. And that's really one of the fundamentals of coaching is that using that lens of curiosity. Okay, what's going on with you? Pretty open-ended question and it reveals a tremendous amount. And you might think, oh, I don't have time for this. It's too complicated. It's how much rework would you like to do when you don't create that true understanding and create an engaged conversation in terms of back channel messaging, the need for more appointments, maybe even visits to the emergency room, or more commonly lengthy inbox messages from patients that really weren't very satisfied and so they're constantly pushing. So in some respects, it's a little bit the go slow to go fast mindset, but for those who are listening saying, oh, wait a minute, I don't have time for this, actually it doesn't take that much time. So.
In your experience, since you've begun using this personally in your interactions with patients, and as you've moved into more of a true coaching business, as you're doing your coaching, have you found that there's an opportunity to help physicians understand how this can be an advantage to them in a clinical setting, or is your coaching more focused on physicians who are using these tools in a non-clinical leadership way?
That's sort of a yes and response, Norm. I have at any one time probably 5 to 7 clients. And right now, a large number of them are clinicians, but are not all. I have some really interesting folks that aren't in healthcare, and I really enjoy that. There are a lot of parallels. So it's a yes and because, again, it's that we are trained to be experts. We're trained to sort of, in a way, a little bit the buck stops here with us clinically. And it's an accountability and a responsibility that all of us take very seriously. And yet, how do we then translate that into the relationships with those we serve and understand that what our agenda is may not be fully aligned with what theirs is? And gaining a good understanding of what the agenda is of the patient can be very helpful for us in terms of acknowledging just how much change they're really willing to do. I mean, we are kind of change agents in many respects and experts, no doubt about that. And frankly, I don't think using a lens of curiosity in the middle of an emergency room setting when you're having to do life-saving procedures, that's a different kettle of fish. I get that. So there's a space and a place for this. But so much of what we do in medical care is chronic disease management, prevention, conversations about health, managing disease burden, all of those types of things. And that is very much a coachable interaction with patients. If you kind of think of them almost as clients, what are you willing to do? Here's what I see. How does that fit in your with your values, how you live your life, and what are you able and willing to do? Boy, that's a really eye-opening set of questions. And the other thing, Norm, something happened to me early on in all of this. Actually, it's funny. I walked and ran a little 5K event this morning. A couple of years ago, I asked the question, could I run a marathon? And so there's a big event here in Grand Rapids that's a 25K, which is 15-plus miles, which is more than a half marathon. So I'll try that, and I'll see. By the way, I concluded after that, nah, I'm not going to run a marathon. But the thing that I did with that was I used a coach to help me stay focused on incremental growth in my pattern of exercise, my diet. We were monitoring blood pressure and weight and all those kinds of things. I thought, well, this is really interesting. And by the way, he asked me, do you want tough love or do you need me to be kind and gentle? At that time, I had a pretty complex leadership job. I said, oh, that's during the day. I need you to be nice to me. He said, okay, that's fine. That's great. So he even asked, what's the style? And I thought, wow, that's really cool. And what I learned from that, Norm, was the concept of the feedback loop. That if you think about what we do in medical care, if someone comes in for a preventive experience or even with a chronic disease, that time interval in between when we encounter them, man, what's happening there? How do you build a feedback loop back in? So serendipity is a word I'm going to use a lot in this conversation because it applies to a bunch of things. I had a patient who was kind of lamenting, I really like rowing machines, but I can't afford one. And I just sort of casually said, why don't you call one of the fitness centers and see if they're selling them? Because sometimes they do when they replace their equipment. He kind of filed that away. And about 8 weeks later, I get this little message in the patient portal. Hey, doc, you were right. I contacted and named the place. And they were selling machines. I bought one for less than $200, probably a $2,000 machine. And he said, I'm in heaven. And then it went dot, dot, dot. By the way, I've lost 8 pounds. And I thought, oh, two pieces happened there. One is feedback. So he had a way to give me feedback. And the other is he had a measurable goal. So I was thinking, how do we do this? So if we're going to ask that question, how likely are you to change and what's your goal? And after people say, I'm going to run 5 miles a day starting next week, and we realize it's going to be 5 blocks to start out with, and you get that plan, I would ask them, could you just send me a quick note, no more than 3 sentences? If it's 3 paragraphs, I'm going to ask you to come in because I don't have time for 3 paragraphs, but I do for 3 sentences, and let me know how things are going in the patient portal. And I had about a dozen patients before I retired that were doing this pretty regularly. I had to nudge a few. But for me, that was a way to build a feedback loop and a bit of an accountability loop for patients. It didn't take a whole lot of time. It wasn't inbox clutter. It was a pretty focused conversation. As I say, for some, it just wasn't their kettle of fish and they didn't like it. But so serendipity, it's a little some past experiences, a patient nudge, recognizing we have tools, and then thinking through, well, how would I put all this together? I wonder, I mean, I have this sort of fantasy that says you'd have, this is what a team would do for a panel of patients, that you would have, you create a plan, and then, if you will, distribute the feedback process to those who are also skilled and upskilled, to be able to respond to this. It's an interesting idea. And I retired before we could really think through what would an operating model look like for this. But I think there's some real options or possibilities here.
I think you're right. And it's interesting. When you and I were working together in the past, I remember one of the physician leaders in our organization who was really involved with value-based care brought up the concept of the white space in the patient experience and how little time we have with patients during a year. But I've been amazed and interested as I've looked at the growth and the interest in other areas such as functional medicine or alternative medicine. One of the things that I think often differentiates those practitioners from maybe traditional allopathic medicine is the number of touches a year and the number of means that they have to touch patients a year who are dealing with chronic and oftentimes somewhat difficult to diagnose problems. And I think people in general just crave that type of contact with their subject matter experts or people that are trying to help them with a problem. I mean, you, I'm sure when you were training for the 15K or 25K, you probably didn't deal with your coach twice a year to help you achieve that goal.
It was every 2 weeks. Yeah.
Right.
And we had incremental things. You know, there are people that say, oh, Ed, data-driven stuff is really, that's in your space. A lot of people don't like that. And there's probably some truth to that. So I try to keep it simple. You know, what's the one thing you want to drive? Okay, let me know how it's going. For this, we had a complex set of variables we were pushing, and I had curiosity and interest. And yeah, and it was an investment. So it was, you build that stuff, but you're right. Well, and yes, and when you asked me the question about the physician leaders versus clinicians, because this same process applies in the physician leadership realm. Getting the hardest part, I think, for us as physician leads, and this I know I went through this, was A, I'm not the smartest one in the room. B, there are people who don't have my credential who are extremely valuable to the success of our organization. And C, there's a lot of ambiguity and vagueness, likely very much rooted in the human experience that isn't going to be defined necessarily by science, a little neuroscience maybe. And so having to have a whole different, a complementary skill set when you're doing this, those are the coachable moments. And it's really the same phenomenon if you think about it. We have to apply our expertise when necessary and recognize that that's not the only arrow in our quiver in terms of being successful in both the clinical role and the leadership role. So I just wanted to follow up on my yes and comment.
Thank you. Thank you. In your current coaching business, I noticed that as I looked at some of your marketing materials and that type of thing, you, especially on LinkedIn, you talk about being both a coach and a mentor. And I wonder if you could help us understand what are similarities between coaching and mentoring, and what are some of the significant differences between being a coach and being a mentor?
I think being a coach is much more difficult. And that's partly because I know that I use intellect and thinking a lot in terms of how I navigate relationships. And that is all about me. A really truly strong coaching relationship is it's really not about the coach at all. It's about the client. The client is seen as whole and complete. And in that context, they think about what their future can look like, not necessarily dissecting the past. And it's not necessarily about skill development or technical knowledge. A mentor might use a coaching mindset, but they also may say, well, gee, I have seen this. I have done this. This is the experience. Did you think about this in leadership? All those sort of questions. I mean, a good mentor will also be someone who uses a lot of coaching technique to bring that forward. But the mentorship is more past experience driven. It is a little bit more about, well, Ed, tell me what you've seen. And I will be very direct with folks saying, I'm going to take my coaching hat off now and say, here's something I have seen. It may not fit for you, but this is what I have seen. And there is a resonance to that type of dialogue. I have to be very cautious with myself to not make it about Ed telling stories. I love to tell stories. I will do that from time to time when someone is stuck, if you will, and they're kind of in a spot where they can't quite figure out what to do. You know, you and I have been around the block enough. You've probably seen enough different organizations and have encountered a lot of different things that often a story will help someone understand what's really going on in them. And that might be a more mentoring kind of thing where we're talking about skills, techniques, that type of stuff.
Okay. All right. Thank you. As you've embarked on your coaching career, obviously healthcare has been going through a massive struggle with COVID. Do you find that there are different challenges being faced by physicians who are in executive leadership roles as compared to non-physicians in those same types of leadership roles?
Ooh, that's a good question. I haven't really had time to think about that. My off-the-cuff answer is rooted, I think, in the, maybe it's too strong a phrase, but I'll just put it out there, that sort of moral injury mindset that many physicians think, well, wait a minute, the system isn't fully supporting how it is I think we ought to do things. And then the challenge of almost the serenity prayer, well, what can I fix and what's not fixable? And then challenging the, is that really not fixable? How do I do this? And oh, by the way, I still have to see a volume of patients and do the things I have to do. So how do I fix all of that? And I'm not certain that there isn't a slight difference in the non-clinicians because they really don't have a clinic. They want to be very careful because I'm deeply respectful of those who take the plunge and particularly those in the middle management roles in medical care, because, man, those are tough roles. And yet the clinicians touch the patients directly, and I certainly feel an accountability to make sure that their health is optimized. A good non-clinician leader will also take that accountability and that responsibility collectively. It's just a different experience. And I do think that certainly the pandemic pointed out a lot of the structural flaws in the medical care provision systems that are out in the country. And my sense is that a lot of physicians are still sort of reeling from this and don't necessarily want to go back to what was and say, well, gee, didn't this expose something? Can we change how we do what we do? A bit of a head scratcher. And then we've got all these mergers and acquisitions and all those things going on. So the dynamic of I am an accountable clinician for a panel of patients, and when I see someone during the day, that's where I focus. And then we've got mega organizations that are getting more mega and more mega. So there's a bit, I think, of a bit of a disconnect sometimes, especially the frontline teams.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way. And I think I've seen the same thing as we've progressed through this. It may be just a little bit, I think there's a perception that there's a little bit of a disconnect, as you said, or a separation from the frontline reality to the C-suite that I didn't notice as much 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But
you know, where that gets exposed, Norm, is in the team coaching. So I've now done formally 6 or 7 teams, 2 in healthcare and both in primary care. And it's really interesting when you get the physician, the APP, the medical assistant, front desk person, and if they have a psychologist or a pharmacist or somebody else, part of the whole team together to help solve a problem. One of the teams wanted to improve their blood pressure results, so very clinically focused. And the other is working on their no-show rates because they recognized they had a challenge, both reaching out to patients. But the big theme that has emerged in this is frontline teams actually recognizing that they can take responsibility for their own circumstances many of the times. And what I mean by that is, I will never forget the first time I had one of the teams, I said, well, okay, you might actually feel like you need to ask your middle management folks if you can do this, but how complete and how much do they really know your business and how complete will their responses be to you? And they all said, well, probably not. They don't get us. I mean, it just opened this Pandora's box of if you will, opinions and points of view. and I had compassion for both the frontline teams and the middle management. I thought, okay, that's a fixable problem. So what happens if you determine what's optimal for patient flow in this particular situation since you know the work? And rather than asking your middle management folks, you come back with them, say, we've noticed this, and here's a fix that we think is going to be very helpful. And when a team, that light goes on and that team finally realize, oh my gosh, we can fix most of this ourselves, how engaging is that? It's very empowering, and it becomes fun. Then you've got this really interesting problem. Well, we want to fix everything. So you do have a little bit of a management question there, but okay, what do we pick? But yeah, it's really exciting when you see that happen. So I actually love coaching the frontline teams.
I was going to ask you, do you find the individual coaching or the team coaching to be more fulfilling?
Oh, you know, it's a great question. If I had my druthers, I'd probably focus on acquiring more teams as clients. Harder to do because there's more cost to it. And the cost is not just the financials, but it's really time away from the production. So that part is a challenge for a lot of clinics. The two that I've had recognized they had some things they had to fix. And we're doing this through a grant process. So in some respects, they had their opportunity costs covered by doing this. But it's leveraged a lot with them.
Have you been doing it long enough to see what the outcomes have been for the team and for the organization?
For the blood pressure one, that we started that one probably 15 months ago. And yes, they have dramatically changed their outcomes. A little bit inspect what you expect. So that was part of the process. They realized, oh, again, that feedback loop. Well, how do we know if we're being successful? Well, why don't you just put it up on your whiteboard and huddle around your whiteboard every day? And they put it in a little teeny, tiny, small print. I said, I can't read that. Let's get out your dry marker and put, 16 over 20 Tuesday on the board. Oh, really? Yeah. So when you walk in and you glance over to the right, you know how you did yesterday. And then during a huddle, you ask, well, gee, we missed those four. What happened? And sometimes it's outlier stuff, but sometimes it's, oh, yeah, our system isn't quite right. Let's try it this way today or this week, and we'll remeasure. It's all PDSA focused, really. And it's wonderful when you start to see that because, man, the creative ideas that come out of the hearts and minds of your frontline teams, astounding.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would like you to talk a little bit about maybe the, as you're going into an individual coaching session, starting with a new client, is there a specific process that you have found to be the most effective in terms of establishing that relationship and setting the foundations for success?
Yeah, I'll finish my team thing. The thing that about teams is you almost always end up doing some individual coaching. And so I'll navigate into that. The formal relationship that I use is I actually do like to, it kind of depends on what people want. So we'll find out what it motivates you to enter into a coaching or a coach / mentor relationship. Once we understand that, and I understand the scope of the work they're expected to do, we then start to frame out at the end of our time period, what does success look like for you? And that is for them. I usually get a, not sure. And that's about this concept of contracting and coaching. And one of the sort of mantras you get taught in this early on is that ABC, always be contracting, because you might 4 weeks into this realize, ooh, yeah, I thought I really wanted to get this, but now I see as we've kind of peeled the onion a bit, this is where I really would like to develop myself. And so you just navigate that accordingly. I like to use, for those in leadership roles, but I actually like to use them for almost everybody, some sort of an assessment tool, whether it's something they have already. I'm a big fan of the Winslow Solutions tool because it aligns with work, actually. They actually have looked at that particular tool to align it with job descriptions. Truth in advertising, I sit on a panel with them, and we're trying to put a medical piece to this as we start to describe typical roles in the medical profession. Because right now, there are things like supervisor, manager one, manager two, technical, and we can fit the clinicians in, but we're actually early on trying to actually solicit input from docs to say, well, these are the psychological attributes that demonstrate success. And these are the behavioral traits that if you exhibit them would be successful. And if you exhibit them would be detrimental. So that company is working on defining all of this. I sometimes use a Hogan if someone has a MMPI they want to share with me, or Enneagrams are pretty popular these days. So there are a lot of tools out there. So if someone already has them, I'll use those. They're great springboards for dialogue and for personal reflection and insight. And then we let them sit, because the real coaching conversation is not about interpreting personality profiles or assessment tools. And you can imagine the dialogue, well, yeah, your assessment says you're this way, so therefore you are. that's not a really, you could say that, but that's not going to resonate very well. What it might say is, I'm curious how you feel about this, that the assessment says this, and then off to the races we go. And if it's then aligned with, well, I have a goal of becoming X or doing Y, then we can understand what motivates that person who wants to do that, or what could be a derailer or something that inhibits their being successful. So I start with tools, but for the most part, it's a set of conversations focused. At the end of each conversation, what are we going to do? What are you going to do between now and next time? So it's very, there's a self-reflective and self-discovery side of this, and then applied. So you've got this meeting coming up with how we've just talked about whatever, being more comfortable in the room, putting on the right, bringing the right presentation, doing the right, all of those things. Tell me your action plan for this next meeting that's coming up that's important to you. And then when we see someone after that, we'll review that and say, well, how did it go? And then what's next? So it's very practical in many respects, but also designed to be self-reflective.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. In thinking about all the tools that you obviously are well versed in and these techniques, you mentioned at the very beginning of our discussion the formal training that you went through as a coach. I get the sense that some executive coaches have done formal training, others have not. How long did that training take, and do you feel that that's a necessary element for someone who is going to be doing the type of work that you're doing?
Great question again, Norm. At the end of the day, the credential is a training experience. The skill and, I don't want to say this, maybe just the effort that a coach or mentor puts in is what makes the experience. Having said that, and the introductory remark I made, boy, I thought I knew until I got some training. So I do encourage the training. The associate certified coach designation through the International Coaching Federation requires that you have, and these are all numbers approximate because I've lost the actual details, roughly 70 hours of training. I think it's still, you have to have 100 hours of coached experience, 70% of which is actually paid. There are requirements for having had your coaching sessions monitored and supervised. And again, I'm kind of blanking on the hours, so that part took probably 6 to 8 months, actually a full year by the time I got my 100 hours and was able to submit that to the ICF, International Coaching Federation. They also have a knowledge assessment test that for most physicians is actually fairly straightforward if you've done some training with this. The advice I got, though, from those who had been doing coaching for a while was, Ed, you're not done. Taking a 6 to 8 month course, getting those basics, those are the basics, strongly encourage you to continue. I had shown an interest or kind of had an interest in the team-based work. So I've actually done now three additional training experiences in team-based coaching, just finishing up in April. We finished our last one. And I also decided, because I do have an interest in coaching physicians, to do the become a certified or master certified physician development coach. So I've invested quite a bit of time and some expenses into the experience. I've been in sort of active training for roughly 3 years. Part of that was the advice that the initial coach I had, who also had a healthcare background, her comment was, yeah, healthcare likes credentials. So you know, she said, I don't necessarily have the credentials that, I don't think she even has an ACC, but she said, I chose to be that. I think in your arena, gaining traction, if you will, or maybe access, the credentials will help. But they are only credentials. So, yeah. For me, the three-year journey has been really helpful. By the way, I have met some amazing people all over the world. One of the teams I did was a group of attorneys in Dubai, of all places. So, yeah. So, I was with another attorney as a co-coach. When you do team coaching, if you've got more than five or six people, a co-coach is really helpful.
That's interesting. I didn't realize you'd had that opportunity to sort of branch outside of the U.S.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The in particular, team-based training, most of that comes out of the U.K. So all of a sudden, you've got this interesting, very diverse group of people, extremely diverse. And so because of their European location, they also have a lot of folks that they do sessions early European time, which is late Asian time. So they have a whole Asian contingency, and then they do the North American thing in their late afternoon, which is our, you know, late morning. So it's been interesting to observe the international basis of all this. Coaching is still pretty much a North American thing. The Europeans are starting to embrace it. And I think the Asian communities are starting to come along as well. But it's, again, this self-reflective stuff. We Americans, I think, are kind of uniquely self-reflective in some respects.
So. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And this has been a great conversation and is a great conversation. And I think we could go along many different paths. But I did want to talk with you a little bit, too, since you and I both pursued our MBA at the University of Tennessee. Where were you in your career when you decided that an MBA would be helpful for you?
Yeah, I'll go back to serendipity. I was just a practicing doc, had done some time in a federally qualified health center. We ended up in Kalamazoo, Michigan after all that. My wife was also a doc, and we'd had our family and all this stuff in that time period. So finally the dust settled, our upper 30s, where are we going to live? And ended up in Kalamazoo for some great reasons. And about the fifth year into that, the leader of the health system that we worked for just tapped me and said, "Hey, Ed, how would you like to go to the MGMA meetings?" And I thought, "Huh? Me? Sure." So I sat next to this person on the plane and found out all about their life. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's a human being behind this person who's our administrative, you know, foil, if you will, because that's how they were perceived. And so that was really helpful to really develop a personal relationship. And when I went to MGMA, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm hearing myself defined and how negatively. Wow, that was quite something. But what also, that was interesting, but the other part that was really interesting is, oh, these spreadsheets, these are really interesting. That's kind of fun stuff. So I think I just had a natural sort of curiosity for those things, a very high tolerance for meetings, which people say, yeah, good for you, Ed. Ed can go to that one. And I think just a natural curiosity. So one thing led to another. I ended up in a quality role, and then new CEO came in, and his model was to have physician partners, and he wanted two. He wanted one on the hospital side and one on the ambulatory side. So he asked me to be the ambulatory lead, and that's when I realized, ooh, I need more skills. The curiosity is going to only go so far. So I told him, I said, you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity. This is something that does interest me a lot. And I also feel like I need some formal training. And he said, pick your program, which was great. Then I thought, ooh, what am I going to do? So I looked at all the branded ones, and there were 22 months, 24 months, lots of time. And then PEMBA came along. And I thought, oh, it's a year? It fits into my schedule. It's perfect. Well, it was longer than a year. You know the drill, Norm. The 32 books arrive in November, And they did. It was a big box. And there was all the suggested reading. So I really got started in November, even though I class matriculated in January. And for me, I always jokingly say it was like going to Berlitz school. It was learning how to read and understand the language of business. And I found myself really enjoying it a lot. We had a cohort of 32. There were four of us that had jobs like I did. And my accountability actually in that job was to take all the ancillary services like radiology and lab, physical therapy, occupant, all the things that weren't in that weren't housed in the hospital, that were not under the hospital tax ID, and then the physician practices, which were their own separate tax ID, put them all together into one business unit. So PEMBA was extremely helpful in that regard. I actually went early on the residency sessions, a day early, and made appointments with faculty. It was free consulting advice, frankly, but I needed to bounce things off of the faculty to help understand where am I on point, what am I missing, help me understand. It was really a lot of mentoring, and for me that was fabulous. So my capstone was, here we are, here's the new department. I didn't get it done in 10 minutes, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure not. Well, it's interesting the value that you found out of it, found out and got out of PEMBA. What was your least anticipated benefit? What surprised you the most that you took away from the PEMBA program?
Well, I think it was the openness of the faculty to be really supportive. I jokingly say I got free consulting, but I don't think they felt it that way at all. I think they really embraced the concept that there were a couple of us that would come early and just sit down and have really long, meaningful time that wasn't about teaching in the class, but it was about our circumstances. And for me, that was like, ooh, wow, icing on the cake. This is really nice. So that was really helpful, extremely helpful.
Obviously, the value of PEMBA was huge in the role that you were in while you were taking PEMBA. Tell me a little bit about the impact of having the MBA on your career and the successive roles that you've had.
That's a great question, Norm. People have always asked, do you need a graduate degree to move on? And I think the philosophical answer is no, but the reality is just like, so, okay, now I have the credentials. So people say, okay, he's done that. He's in the mix to consider. It could be an MPH, it could be an MBA. I mean, I kind of felt the MPH side, I'm in primary care. I'm pretty focused on population health. I do get the dynamics of measuring, if you will, social impact, all those kinds of things. So for me, it was, I wanted the business development skills more than that. I mean, I see the benefit of either. And I think the benefit of either is having to put together think programmatically and think big and think strategically, and then be really, if you will, forced to create a plan around that. So again, the capstone was all focused on capstone, and it was a great capstone because it was a big business thing. The other thing, Norm, I will say that if I were to put a plug for any potential department in an organization, it is actually HR, but you got to find the good HR people. Some are just very transactional and almost rigid in their perspective. Others see the big picture, understand what you're doing. So I don't think I would have been successful in anything that I had done if I had not recognized how and found the right people and human resources to help navigate all the issues that are part of just navigating being a leader. And that was true for putting this department together early on. It's been true, I think, in virtually every leadership role I've had, which is kind of interesting. That was a bit unexpected.
So tell me a little bit about what your five-year plan is for Pivot Partnerships.
Ah, good question. My wife is asking this question. Ed, you're retired. What? I certainly don't want 80-hour work weeks. Those 60-hour, well, 65 is unrealistic. Those leadership weeks where meetings four nights a week and still answering emails Saturdays and Sundays, that's all stopped. So my interest is in doing this roughly no more than 20 hours a week, and we'd like to do some travel, so probably 40 to 45 weeks a year. And I can do it remotely. I do the team-based coaching I have. I'm doing locally, so that's done face-to-face. And 5 years from now, yeah, I think what I really would like 5 years from now is to have a cadre of clinician partners that we work together to coach teams or coach individuals, and that we almost get to the point where we're passing clients back and forth because we see, oh, Norm's really good at this. Go partner with him. Or, Sabala's good at this. Go partner with her. So that we almost become conduits. That would be great. That assumes there's demand. And I think the flip side of that is short-term still creating interest and demand for coaching. I actually believe, Norm, that every physician ought to have a coach.
I was going to ask you that question if you were in that mindset, but I assumed that you were, but I should have asked it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I've been in three different organizations in leadership and two reporting directly to the CEO, and I've watched the nursing education, the nursing onboarding, and the nursing support process, and it's very different than what we do with physicians. And there's a little bit of envy in that because there's intentionality around supporting those clinical teams. And I think we get kind of thrust into this stuff. You show up to work on Monday, maybe you get 8 hours of orientation. Tuesday, you learn how to use the medical record. Wednesday, here's your panel. And, oh, by the way, a year from now, we expect it to be full. Pat on the back. And every now and then, one of your colleagues, who's probably deathly afraid of giving you any negative criticism, will come by and ask you, well, how's it going? I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek, but I think that is the reality for a lot of clinicians. And it's like, wow, what a missed opportunity. The how's it going should be, how is it going? And a true opportunity 6 weeks in, 12 weeks in, 18, and just a constant sort of support piece. I mean, we do this with any other high reliability team member in any other high reliability organization. You have to have those folks intact. Why are we not doing this with docs? This makes no sense to me.
Yeah, that's
so great. That's my soapbox.
Oh, that's a great observation.
If I were to have a coaching soapbox. So I think there's tremendous opportunity. The nice thing is that we are seeing health systems, medical provision systems. I have a whole different attitude about what health is, but that's a different podcast. And I've seen that many starting to put coaching programs in place for clinicians. And it's not just for those who are having troubles, for those who are just saying, hey, we have this for you to help you stay, if you will, grounded, focused, be clear about what you want, and stay engaged. And that, to me, is a very positive offshoot of what's happened post-pandemic.
Great. Well, thank you for your comments. We've kind of gotten to the end of our time, but I know from talking with you that you have your coaching is a combination of a vocation and avocation, right, as a physician. But I know that you have you mentioned your interest in health and your exercise and running and that type of thing. But I also know that you have gotten involved in another kind of interesting and unique adventure with your orchestra work. And I wonder if you could share with the audience a little bit about not only what you're doing, but how you find that helps you in your work-life balance and those kinds of things.
Well, I'm an amateur viola player. I started actually playing string instruments when I was six and took about a 15-year hiatus. We went to Kalamazoo, finally got back into playing in community orchestras. And in retirement, I actually had a chance to really explore that. And where it links back into what I'm doing professionally is, man, an orchestra is a gigantic team. I mean, if you think about American football or baseball, and I used to say the coaches for our kids when they were playing baseball, every time the ball is in motion, all nine players move. And, well, that's true. If you watch the professionals, some of them move rather leisurely. But and in football, of course, you've got all these complex, very clearly defined roles. Well, orchestra's got, various sections. And so you have to bring your individual skills. But if you're not listening, and if you're not trying to be something greater than just yourself in any ensemble, it's not going to come out. And that's what the conductors do. They often point out, okay, first violins, you're probably not really listening to what's going on with the oboe. So let's have the oboe play this. And I want you to link what you're doing with that. Oh, good. So it's really part of being, it's being part of a team. And I was doing this when I was in leadership. It was great because I didn't have to lead. I could actually just follow, which was wonderful. Or be led might be the better way to say it. So I enjoyed that. And then there's a camaraderie. When you're on all four cylinders playing something, there it's a magical experience. So yeah, it motivates.
I think there are connections there. I remember years ago when I went to a physician executive leadership course, and they brought in the conductor from the Boston Symphony or one of the large symphonies out on the East Coast. And
was
his whole
Zander?
Yes, it was. Ben Zander. Yeah.
Yep.
And he did such a great job of drawing parallels between several things that I think we struggle with in healthcare. Number one is that the conductor isn't the best player in every section in the orchestra. In fact, they probably aren't the best player in any section in the orchestra. And in healthcare, we struggle with a physician leader who may lack expertise, and some physician experts in the trenches feel like that disqualifies you from being a leader. And I thought that was a real aha moment for me. And I still remember when he was teaching us that very, very relevant piece of information, I thought. And then secondly, he just talked about how each member of the orchestra, whether it's the percussion player who hits the triangle three times during a performance, or if it's the soloist, they're all really equally important to the success of the performance. And I thought that was another great takeaway from Ben Zander. That was, I'll include his links in the show notes for people, because I think he has a lot of great YouTube videos now, and he got a lot of great training content out there that would be fun for people to look at.
I actually saw one of his videos and I wept. He did one with a cellist who was playing one of the Bach cello suites that was supposed to be a dance. And he polled the audience, he said, how many of you felt like dancing? And it was the right question asked at the right time. It wasn't insulting. The cellist was like, oh, that's a great question. And most of them kind of lukewarm. They were nice there. I think they're trying to be supportive. But he said, how would you play this if you wanted to get that audience to dance? And she got this look on her face of, oh, game on. And I heard this remarkable difference. And it made me weep. It was like, oh, I want a conductor like that. I also want to be able to play like that. And it was one of those moments. When you read his book, The Art of Possibility, same emotional intelligence emerges out of all of that. That you think, wow, performance is so different than we might think. We've all heard technically skilled musicians where you kind of went, okay, but the ones who have transcended the technical stuff, who then can express, oh my gosh! So I'm in that phase where I'm getting past the technical things, finally start taking lessons again. The instructor I have is encouraging that kind of stuff. And I'm learning how to, and this is probably a great moment, a great learning moment, is I'm learning how to let the small stuff, the small mistakes, just let them be, pay attention to them, you can fix them. But are you saying something with this music? At the end of the day, is the audience going to go, oh, I really like that? And I think we get so focused on, did I do it right? And it may be, did I do it well? And the well may not be perfect, but when it's well, it resonates. So yeah, there's a lot that goes on. And boy, you can tell when an orchestra's playing and they're on, it's like, wow. So,
and I'd like healthcare
moments.
Yeah. And I think if we as physician leaders can remember that our goal is to give our patients that same wow experience, right? When our teams are really on and we're really creating an experience for that patient that helps them achieve their health goals and it helps them live the way that they want to live, they should walk out of that experience saying, wow, I've really just had a great experience, and these people were really on their game today. And there's so many parallels that when I heard him talk and I hear you talk, it just, I got to go back and read his book again because.
Oh yeah. It's one of my favorites. And you know what happens in that setting, Norm, is they cut you some slack for the little errors. So if you missed a prescription or if you did something, it's like, oh, hey doc, you know, remember we were going to do that. It's very different than that. So-and-so didn't do stuff. I knew he was bad. Completely different. That for me, it's a point of pride. I've actually never been sued, and I think I passed the statute. So yay, 30 some odd years.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I wasn't the smartest guy in the room by any means. And patients would point out stuff, but when you do that with humility and a strong relationship, it's done. I mean, you just fix it. Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks. Good observation. So
that's great. Well, this has been a great conversation, Ed. I very, very much appreciate you taking the time to come on to PEMBA On Demand and to participate in this podcast. As you know, this is part of the Physician Leadership Symposium now. We've kind of switched it over to the podcast and live stream mode. As a way to reach out to alumni and to physicians who are interested in maybe pursuing an MBA. And we want them to consider, of course, the University of Tennessee. So I appreciate you taking the time. I look forward to our next conversation. There's a lot more that we can explore.
Yeah. Well, and thanks, Norm, for doing this. I really appreciate your efforts. I will say that PEMBA is the perfect level of training for any clinician that is transcending into leadership. No, they're not going to send you to Singapore. You're not going to go to Spain. So if you want to do that, go to one of the other branded schools. But if you want really good fundamental skills and the ability to have a really deeply collegial conversation around developing your skills as a business leader, I can't think of a better place.
Great. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add PEMBA On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.